Insight, a media platform produced by the National Film Board of Canada. These podcasts are independently created by people like you. Go to citizen.nfb.ca to contribute.
Welcome to episode 79 of the Citizen Shift podcast, Virtual Bullying, Real Consequences. I'm Tim McSorley. Chat rooms, Facebook, text messages, instant messaging, MySpace. Our ways of communicating wirelessly and online seem to grow every day, and no group is more connected than young people. 99% of all Canadian students have used the internet. 60% frequent chat rooms and use instant messaging. Nearly half use the internet for about an hour each day. And most of this communication is harmless, and it's often helpful in building ties with friends. But like everyday interaction outside the virtual world, some encounters can be harmful or even dangerous. Not surprisingly, bullying has made its way onto the internet. Insulting or threatening messages can be left on MySpace or Facebook profiles any time of day and for the public to see. A third of Canadians now say they know someone who has been bullied online. Like many aspects of our growing internet use, people are struggling to identify exactly how to deal with cyberbullying. NetSafe is a New Zealand nonprofit organization specializing in online safety. In July 2008, the NetSafe conference was held in Queenstown, New Zealand. The international conference brought together participants from a variety of universities and industries. They came together to talk about ways to promote awareness and safety around issues related to cyberbullying in digital and offline spaces. Dana Salter is a graduate student in education at McGill University in Montreal. She attended the conference, and today she brings together three of those participants as they talked about ways to approach the relationships between digital technologies, social responsibility, and cyberbullying. Jeff Cole runs the Center for the Digital Future at the USC Annenberg School. We begin with Professor Cole, as he situates emerging digital technologies in the broader history of technology and communication, and the impact that this can and has had on society.
I've always been interested in how people adapt to technology. And I'm 8 years into this large project that we believe is the study of the web that we thought should have been conducted of television. We thought that we lost this great opportunity to track people before they had television and to follow them as they acquired and used it to see how it changed their lives. And we're convinced that the impact of digital technology, the web and now mobile communication, will be far more significant than television. So believing we lost this opportunity with television and that the impact of the web is going to be even greater, 8 years ago we launched this project, this study of the web that we thought should have been conducted of television. We started in the United States and we are tracking people. We've gone on for 8 years in a row and watching as non-users go to dial-up, as dial-up users move to broadband. And I think broadband changes everything because of the always-on. We watch as about 2% drop off the web each year, and we want to know who are these people who leave and why, and more importantly, do they return, and if so, when and what brings them back. And then 8 years in, we continue to track the never users. We started in the United States. We're in about 30 countries around the world. We continually add countries. We just added last year New Zealand, who just released their first report here in Queenstown. And as far as when will we stop, well, the question is, if you had done this in 1948 for television, when would you have stopped? And the answer probably is, we'll stop when it stops getting interesting.
Okay.
And the airline said, that's probably almost never, although, so we have no plan. The data, the insights get far more interesting as you have more years to do it.
Okay.
And fortunately, we're able to support this work easily because we work with governments around the world. We work with companies sharing insights, cutting data, so we're able to afford to continue to do it.
What are some interesting things the data has shown you that you've seen?
Well, we knew when we started the project, our bias was clearly we thought the web was going to grow in importance.
Okay.
Why would we bother doing this if we thought it was going to disappear?
Yeah.
Although it was funny, during the meltdown, during the bust in 2002, It was funny, the number of people who came up to me pretending to be sympathetic, but actually sort of smiling, saying, well, what are you going to do now?
Yeah.
Now that this internet thing is over with, which they actually were thrilled at the prospect, and our work showed it was only getting more vital. So we knew communication was changing. We knew the way people formed relationships through email was changing. Those were the predictable things. The things we couldn't have predicted that have been most interesting, the rise of social networking, okay, to where our American data in 2007 shows that 55% of people who are members of communities say their online worlds are as important to them as their offline worlds. The huge rise in user-generated content, where everybody wants to be a publisher or a writer. The tremendous change in traditional media, how quickly newspapers would become threatened, radio would change, even I think education will change. I think the greatest long-term impact will be how we learn, particularly for elementary schools. We can go on talking about how it's changing parenting, dating, relationships, business. We can go on in a religion.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing that's not being affected, and I think most things are being completely transformed. How we buy, what we buy, all of that.
Absolutely.
And you, as a college student, of course.
Oh.
And central to everything you do.
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be able to do a thing.
Makes you wonder how you would do what you did today. And the answer is you wouldn't. Or a conference like this would take a year to plan. I know.
It's fascinating, and you hit on two issues. One I wanted to come back to was your thoughts on how, if you could go a little deeper on how it's impacting education and learning. I think definitely learning and the ways we are learning, there's a lot of research coming in cognitive science, as you know, about social context of learning and digital technology.
Well, I'm not a developmental psychologist,
sure.
I'm sure you, but we know that it's fundamental to learn.
Mm-hmm.
We know that kids are learning now long before they get to school. You know, when the California school system, I don't know what it was like in the school system you went through, they used to teach typing in the eighth grade. There isn't a kid who gets to the eighth grade now who hasn't been typing and sitting in a keyboard for 5 years. So we're learning before school. Our big problem at K through 12 is assuming schools have the resources and the facilities, and that's a big issue to itself.
Absolutely.
But assuming they do, the bigger short-term impediment is the teachers, some of whom really embrace and know how to use this technology, some of whom are threatened. So what we have is we have the technologies ahead of the people, and I think that's true, but there's no doubt it's going to change everything. It means that if you're fortunate enough to grow up in Los Angeles or New York or Atlanta, where there are great universities and great libraries, you had an advantage. Now you can have access to those same advantages, whether you're in rural Illinois or whether you're in the middle of Africa or in the middle of Central Asia or up in the Yukon in Canada. So it levels the playing field more. The phenomenal opportunities are great, but we're not going to see them fully maximized, I don't think, until kids, you know, learn from teachers who really embrace. And some do.
We continue now with Donna Cross, whose research examines how a broadening discussion of digital technologies can lead to a broadening discussion of the impact and role of cyberbullying in society. She further explains that what she calls an ecological approach might be the best way to approach this issue.
I'm Donna Cross, and I'm from the Child Health Promotion Research Centre at Edith Cowan University in Western Australia. And I have a research centre there called the Child Health Promotion Research Centre. And that research centre focuses on applied children's research, and bullying and cyberbullying is about 60% of our work. I think the dilemma that we have in this area, you know, are we looking at cyberbullying or are we looking at cyberaggression? I made the comment yesterday that, you know, is flaming just an argument written in print? You know, is it truly bullying? And bullying technically means that it's repeated, there's intentional harm, and where there's a power imbalance. And So when we look at cyberbullying for young people, we ask them to describe what are the behaviours that they think, where they are feeling uncomfortable and where they think somebody is using power over them or where they're intending to hurt them. So using elements of the definition for them to then tell us what those behaviours are. So I think in defining it from an adult perspective, that it needs to have each of those three elements, that it's a difference of power, there's intention and it's repeated. But we also need to look at the specific behaviours that children are engaging in and trying to find out what it is that they're experiencing, because I think as technology changes, so will the sorts of behaviours that we see as young people find new ways to engage and disengage with their peers.
You made a great distinction between how we define it as adults. Have you heard, what do the young people say it is?
Yes. They use lots of words. They've not. I don't think I've had a single child of the hundreds. Yes, who've used that term. Although they're starting to now because the media is using that term, so they're associating that with the behaviour. But for young people, it's about kids doing mean stuff to them to hurt them deliberately online and where it follows them. And I know there was one quote that I used yesterday about being tethered to your tormentor, and that's how they see it because this person is constantly with them so much, the repeated element, that they just feel like they can't escape from that level of humiliation and the other sorts of behaviours that young people are engaging in.
And that unable to escape carries over to discussions that in this digital age, you know, when you leave school, it doesn't stop.
That's right.
In fact, it's worse, you know.
It's 24 hours a day. Young girls don't turn their mobile phones off at night and they put them under their pillow, so they hear the beep beep constantly, you know, so they're not sleeping. Even if they do turn it off, all the messages are accumulating. So wake up in the morning, the first thing they see are, you know, these dreadful messages that they're getting. So it's the constancy of it that I think that kind of takes bullying just to another level. And of course, all of those other elements that I talked about yesterday.
And that crosses over into the wellness. You know, if you're not sleeping, you're constantly anxious, constantly stressed.
Yes, internalizing and externalizing of that behavior on children's mental health is just extraordinary. And we see physical health effects. You know, children with tummy aches, headaches, bedwetting, you know, engaging in behaviours that you would only see under a very stressed child. Ill health, you know, children who are not well getting less well, you know, asthmatics, and children who have epilepsy because the stress is obviously affecting their immune system and autoimmune functioning. So it's the effect, when you talk about, you know, well-being, you know, the holistic, the effect of bullying, it just affects all aspects of your well-being. You know, there's a broken trust.
Yeah.
We're a society that needs trust. You know, education will only work as a vaccine if you get herd immunity. And when you immunise a group against a disease like diphtheria or tetanus, there needs to be enough of the group who get the vaccine to protect those who don't get it. There's some overall presence that the disease can't transfer. And I think an ecological approach is a way of getting herd immunity, because we can't just educate children in school. We have to educate their parents, because children spend time outside of their home, clearly. And we need to educate librarians, and we need to educate coaches and all the people that young people come in contact with. And I think a true ecological approach might focus on the school as their primary delivery point, but then there's, you know, strategies that need to be put in place to make sure that other groups that young people come in contact with have consistent messages, have consistency around behaviours that they find unacceptable and what behaviours they want to see occurring, so that young people can see that there's is a standard, that sort of a moral standard that the community exists. But if every time they meet with a different adult who says, oh, well, that's actually okay, you know, actually that's good, oh, that must be fun, they're getting all these mixed messages about whether this behaviour is being condoned or otherwise. So to truly get herd immunity, we need nice, consistent messages, and we need opportunities to create awareness and educate in an ecological model all those key stakeholders.
In light of the complexities of cyberbullying, what can we as individual stakeholders, as teachers, parents, coaches, family members, or friends, do to help a child, student, or friend who is being cyberbullied? We end now with Will Gardner, who discusses how his organization is approaching cyberbullying in direct and practical ways. Gardner shifts the discussion away from emerging digital technologies being the sole culprit and towards the larger societal issues out of which these behaviors emerge.
My name is Will Gardner. I'm the Deputy Chief Executive of ChildNet International. ChildNet International is a children's charity, and our mission statement is helping to make the internet a great and safe place for children. So we want to try and make sure that children get the best out of this technology, but at the same time ensure that they're able to do it in a safe way. So we're very positive about technology. We see that it's got good stuff to offer young people. We want to make sure that they can exploit those potential right. positives. But at the same time, we want children to use it safely and responsibly.
When you talked in your earlier session about parents and trying to educate or work with parents to learn about the technologies, how have you guys been received? Like, a part of parents?
There's a real demand for parents. Demand for good advice, information on internet.
Okay.
Internet, not just the negatives, you know, on the right. positives. What is it good about the internet? Because there's often a lot of negative media stories
Absolutely.
About children and technology and dangers and the risks. So parents want to know, well, what is good about it? What are our children doing on it? And what do I need to know in order to keep them safe?
Okay.
And there's a real demand for that information. We produced a resource last year, a CD-ROM, that schools could order for free to give parents. It's called Know It All for Parents. And the idea that parents would watch the resource and learn a lot more or know it all about their children's use of technology. And in 6 months, all 1 million copies were ordered and they've gone. So it really just demonstrates the scale of the demand for good information in this space.
Okay.
Last year, we wrote some guidance for schools on cyberbullying to help them to come to terms with the issue that they were struggling to deal with. But we didn't just want to write guidance for schools and say, well, here's the guidance, go and deal with it. We wanted to give them something that would enable to put that guidance into practice better. And part of the guidance is saying, try and raise awareness about cyberbullying. Make sure that people through the whole school community recognize what cyberbullying is, recognizing that it does have an impact, and recognize that it's not an acceptable use of technology. It has no place in our society.
Yeah.
So to raise people's awareness and to make sure they know that we can do something to prevent and respond to it. So that was the rationale. And we produced this film, which then schools can order for free, and then teachers can take it off the shelf as a lesson plan inside a booklet, inside the case, and they can go in the classroom, and they will feel confident to be able to deal with the issues that we want them to talk about.
That was Dana Salter in conversation with Will Gardner, Donna Cross, and Jeff Cole at the 2008 NetSafe conference. As always, you're invited to keep the discussion going on our website. Visit citizen.nfb.ca/podcast to share your thoughts and ideas on cyberbullying. Also, make sure to visit our site in early 2009 when we'll be posting an in-depth dossier on cyberbullying. That's citizen.nfb.ca. I'm Tim McSorley, and this has been episode 79 of the Citizenship Podcast. Thanks for listening.